Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. Okay, we are in paper 51, section 2, which is old single column, page 582. Let's see, I think all we have to do to sort of just remember where we left off. Recall that in that last paragraph of the previous section, how we they were alluding a little bit to the whole dematerialization, rematerialization, mysterious transport aspect of getting a material being from point A to point B when you don't want to, you know, take forever, you know, by slow boat. If you want to actually in seraphim them and get them there, how there's a lot of mysteries to that. You can see this section two is about the transit of the planetary atoms, who are indeed material sons and daughters. So this, you know, this is definitely in play, and they give a little bit more info about it here. They add mystery to a greater degree than they clarify, though, as you'll see. It's one of the more frustratingly non-explained statements in the book in this section. So we'll probably spend a little time pondering that. But you know, that's the basic issue, is just you know, thinking about that issue of how to get a material being from point A to point B, and that's, you know, that's sort of, you know, basic sort of practical physics, you know, physical issue. You know, remember they were dealing with some of that in the first section too, when we were talking about exactly what kind of nature their body is and how they have the two different energy systems, sort of, you know, that they don't really explain. Remember, they have, you know, they're giving us little tidbits about the physics of material sons and daughters, but not a lot of clarification to most of the things they say. Just kind of intriguing little clues. All right, let's see what they have here.
Number two, transit of the planetary atoms. Upon receipt of the news that another inhabited world has attained the height of physical evolution, the system sovereign convenes the core of material sons and daughters on the system capital, and following the discussion of the needs of such an evolutionary world, two of the volunteering group, an Adam and an Eve, of the senior core of material sons, are selected to undertake the adventure, to submit to the deep sleep preparatory to being inseraphimed and transported from their home of associated service to the new realm of new opportunities and new dangers.
So they're still in that mode like we saw them last time. And they keep both edges of the sword in front of our eyes just to remind us of how there's lots of dangers, because they aren't that different from us. They may have this additional energization and whatnot, and sort of higher energizations that are like ours, but of a higher quality and whatnot. But still, when all is said and done, they have agitant mind, just like we do. I mean, they're working with the same basic mind energy system that we are. They obviously have the potential to use it in a more holistic fashion than us if they challenge themselves appropriately to be moving ever upward in relationship to mind. But in other ways, they have a greater challenge than we do. Like we mentioned, they're very definitively expressed male, female, whereas we aren't as black and white, you know, if you will, as definitively bifurcated. You know, there's a little bit of shades of gray to us, so that we aren't so basically hopelessly dependent on the other sex. We can pick up the slack a little bit, but they're very dependent. You know, remember how they mentioned that they are designed to serve on almost all assignments in pairs, how they said that last time. So they just kind of keep tossing that little reminder in about, just like with every measure of creativity you are given, there's an equal measure of potential destructivity comes along with it. Nothing is, there's no innate divinity to these beings, very much like us. Now, notice just maybe the one little thing that reminds you of that when we went through all those different types of mortals on a nativity sphere, the initial evolutionary world. There's all kinds of variations. And so when they say, and following the discussion of the needs of such an evolutionary world, right, so they lay out, okay, exactly what you have a non-breather world here, do you have a high gravity world? Is it a sub-breather world? Is it, all these variations, all that sort of stuff. They got to lay that all out, and so that those that are volunteering, have the specifics up front, and then based upon that, they make this decision, like they said. So, there's obviously some definitive systematics to this selection, but they don't explain. I mean, they just say, that they're selected. There's a volunteering group. They tell you that much. So it isn't everyone in play. And they say that it's a senior core. So you got that clue. But the specifics are all, kind of just left to our imagination. Not to mention, obviously, a lot of the details are not understandable to us, exactly what they're looking at to make the selections and whatnot. But everything, as we've seen over and over and over again, there's never anything random in the cosmos, right? It's all just endless order within order within order, and that's always a lesson that you can learn, no matter how boilerplate something might be that you're reading. It at least is reminding you of that. That nowhere in the universe of universes is there any I that's undotted that goes unnoticed, that it's undotted. I mean, everything is, everyone is on top of everything. There are no details that are slipping through the cracks anywhere. And that all comes back to our world to just recognize that, there isn't anything that you noticed, but apparently, the angels or God or, everyone else is missed, and boy, it's a good thing that you noticed that, so that, you can be right there to make sure the universe doesn't blow up. That never, ever, ever happens. Everything is known 10,000 times beyond our imagination of detail, right? You are fully known. Every jot and tittle is fully known. The master physical controllers are aware of where, every blob of matter is, nothing, is out of sight and not tended to.
Slips through the cracks.
Nothing slips through the cracks. That's the kind of universe you have to know that you live in, and even if it appears that that's not the case, stop realityizing that appearance. That appearance is not the truth. The truth is that it's a completely managed, cared for, in intimate detail, universe, no one has dropped the ball. So you got to know that definitively, because you can't move from faith to trust if you predicate your understanding of reality on the appearance, especially in the early stages of an evolutionary domain. Right? You have to know the reality behind the appearance. Despite all appearances to the contrary, no real harm can befall you, period. That this world is cared for as if it's the only world in the universe, right? And there's beings beyond number to handle it. I mean, you have to just know that. And until you know that unshakably, your faith will not get grown into trust. And you'll be forever a child. You'll never begin to do the step one that Jesus told you to do, to fear not. You have to just know the reality that lies behind the appearances, you know, especially when that appearance doesn't say God to you, or divine to you, or whatever, or good to you, or true to you. You have to know otherwise. All right, so the order of everything. Everything has got a whole precise process that sees to it. All right, what else do they say here?
Adams and Eves are semi-material creatures, and as such, are not transportable by seraphim. They must undergo dematerialization on the system capital before they can be inseraphimed for transport to the world of assignment. The transport seraphim are able to effect such changes in the material suns and in other semi-material beings as enable them to be inseraphimed, and thus to be transported through space from one world or system to another. About 3 days of standard time are consumed in this transport preparation, and it requires the cooperation of a life carrier to restore such a dematerialized creature to normal existence upon arrival at the end of the seraphic transport journey.
Okay, now there's a number of fun little tidbits there, so let's kind of just go through it sequentially here. So, notice that they definitely call them semi-material. Okay, notice that one up front, even though they're called material sons and daughters because of what they were telling us in the previous section, but not really explaining. You don't want to think of them as merely material creatures like us. They're us plus some more, basically, sort of archetype us plus some more. Hence calling them semi-material. Now, whether or not you're supposed to take that semi-literally, and I mean, it's literally half and half, probably not. But nonetheless, that even though they have that additional nature, their material nature that we understand is just as material as our material nature, and hence cannot be transported. Any matter that's like us can't be in seraphimed. That cup of tea, the camera in front of me, whatever. I mean, that can't be in seraphimed. And remember what they told us back when we were reading about Gerasim, that technically what they're doing is they're not turning it into some sort of amorphous energy blob or something. I'm putting it into the transport seraphim. They're just taking that material form and modifying in a way that we can't understand, so that it's kind of like Morantia energy, and hence is transportable and seraphimable. So that dematerialization is sort of a re-energizing, if you will, they're reforming it with a different energy material, raw material, foundation, however you want to think about it. Okay, so that's what they're doing, and you're thinking, well, maybe the stuff that isn't so definitively material, maybe it doesn't have to be changed at all. Maybe you just have to change the basic material part, and the other stuff kind of just stays there in association with it. I mean, again, we can't know because we don't understand the physics we're talking about here. But you have that, and you notice in the process of that, the next time they mention semi-material, you can affect such changes in the material suns and in other semi-material beings. Notice that little interesting little You know, remember, there's all kinds of beings that they don't reveal to us in the book here, and you're going, other semi-material beings, who are they? You know, I mean, we don't know. There's probably, you know, zillions of different ones that they haven't told us about. So it isn't just material sons and daughters and humans that you might that this needs to be done. There's all kinds of unrevealed beings that this has to be done for. Just like, remember, they also mentioned, we talked about Gerasim, that there's all kinds of Marantia beings that they don't reveal. You know, it's not just us as ascenders that are Marantia beings. There's all kinds of unrevealed Marantia beings that we'll come into relationship with when we get to the mansion worlds. Right, so that little tidbit in passing. And then, you know, they're mentioning it again, and it's worth re-emphasizing. You know, this, you know, one of these mysteries that no one, you know, including the revelators, understand, because they're one of the secrets, you know, the Father's worlds, you know, you're reminded again about how different transport seraphim are from just run-of-the-mill seraphim, right? I mean, not only are transport seraphim literally, you know, morphologically different, you know, with the whole thing where they can, you know, take on a passenger like that and encase them in the shielding and all that, but they have this amazing energy manipulative ability. I mean, notice that they don't say they bring in master physical controllers and Marantia power supervisors to do this modification. The transport seraphim do it, and you may recall that, you know, that when transport seraphim aren't literally serving as transport angels, you know, they kind of serve as teaching you physics and stuff. Okay? So they know a lot about physical stuff, and, you know, and you can see why. I mean, see, again, they're kind of shades of a power being, besides being shades of a ministering spirit. Again, you know, similar to what we saw with midwares. You know, where a midwayer, on the one hand, you can kind of think of them as, you know, as a kind of angel-like, but on the other hand, they're kind of power being-like, you know. And so, you know, unlike the midwayers, though, that are a power personality synthesis like that, sort of in direct relationship to the evolving, you know, experiential deity that's a power, you know, power personality synthesizing phenomenon, you know, and so that you have that the midway is welling up in relationship to supremacy welling up, you have you know, a downstepping of that, the synthesis prior to the beginning, you know, that there is the nature of synthesis is inherent in the third source and center, right? Because it's bringing, you know, the creator side and the controller side, the spirit side and the material side together, you know, from the eternal sun, paradise isle, duality, right? I mean, that's being brought together as an existential synthesis rather than an experiential synthesis, right? And so here you see shades of that, you know, what you might kind of think of as a recessive aspect of the third source and center, downstepping it to angels, and out pops signs of the fact that there's more than, you know, than just a spirit side to this creature, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, there's more than just an agent of creators sort of a phenomenon. There's an agent of controllers, if not a controller, you know, side to the being. Okay, so yeah, that's again why, you know, transport seraphim are, you know, are different. They have this this internalized duality that the other seraphim don't have.
Right? Do they have to have then in their nature? They have to have this vast spectrum from material, or at least semi material. Mm-hmm. To spiritual,
right?
To be able to do that process.
Yeah, yeah. See, is that's kind of the corollary to what I just said. It's just appreciating that not only can they function broadly like that. I mean, the only reason something can function broadly is if it is innately by nature something that's broad in nature, right? I mean,
yes.
Right? You can't act outside of your nature. And so if they're going to act broadly, their nature has to be, span a lot of the spectrum like that. So they have to be able to relate to a wide range of energy, physical, spiritual energy phenomena in order to do what they do.
In another part of the book, I'm not sure the right word is that, but it's talking about being in seraphim, only in seraphim celestial beings. Mm-hmm. And it says that it gives incredible detail.
Mm-hmm.
It says that they turn horizontally.
Right, yeah.
And
back there with the angels, yeah.
The celestial being is put on top of them, placed, and they have those two double shields, the mm-hmm. upper shields,
right.
and the
right.
which are both double shields, but they do this quivering thing, vibrating thing, that
yeah.
I think is the word they use,
yeah.
and then they become nearly transparent through this amber hue.
Right.
I'm trying to study it because I'm very interested in this right now, but
mm-hmm.
So that gives us clues, although I don't think of celestial beings in the same way that I think of material sons and daughters or semi-material beings,
mm-hmm.
but they have that much more spectrum in their nature to do that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the basics of what you were remembering there from, it's back there when they're going through all the different angels and, when they talk about the different orders of transport seraphim, they've got those descriptions that we read a while back. You remember they're talking about how as this is getting prepared, as the transport seraphim and its passenger are getting prepared to take off, right? It's beginning to delocalize, right? I mean, it's and that's the problem with anything that's quote unquote semi-material or material, right? Because if it's material, it can't be delocalized like that. I mean, a material thing is fundamentally localized relative to finite space and time, and can't be delocalized. So you have to modify it to something that can be delocalized like that, because that's what the transport seraphim is doing. It's not just staying localized and moving through space really fast. You can't stay localized and even go the speed of light, let alone almost three times the speed of light. You have to decouple a bit, delocalize a bit from the finite, right? And if you were to try to somehow imagine delocalizing my body would just come apart, right? I mean, it couldn't be my body, right? My body is a localization in finite space and time, whereas when you go above our nature a bit, the beings, the energy, nature, the body of that being is at least potentially not as localized relative to finite space and time as we think. Right? Right? I mean, it can go effectively three times the speed of light because it has a third of the relationship to space and time that we do. Yeah, if you're going to go 4.5 million times the speed of light, then you have to have 1/4 million. Millionth, the relationship to space and time that we do. I mean, because you that's all that means. Those aren't literal speeds, those are effective speeds. Right? You are delocalizing and then relocalizing at a different place. Right? And how completely you can delocalize is how effectively quick you can go from point A to point B. If you can completely delocalize, right, then it takes zero time to go from point A to point B. But if you can almost completely delocalize, then you'll get there, really fast, like a solitary messenger, or nearly as much delocalization, it'll be like a Trinity being, a divine counselor or something like that, right? I mean, it just depends on how much you can sort of get out of the space and time, right, and go above it, transcend it, however you want to think about it, right? A gravity messenger, it can just, or let's not take a gravity messenger. Let's just take something more close to home. Let's take your adjuster, right? If you had a self-acting adjuster and it left your body, right, it can completely delocalize from the way it's right now. It's imprisoned in your mind, completely localized in your mind. It can completely delocalize, and now it's effectively everywhere, you know, in the master universe, and then it can just relocalize and be anywhere else, right? And it doesn't take any time, because you're not traveling. You're just delocalizing and then relocalizing. Okay, so anyway, yeah, so it comes back around full circle, why it is that they have to dematerialize these things, because it has to be something that can go along with that delocalization ride that transport seraphim is going to do. You know, so if you have a Mirantia body, see, it's not as stuck down into relationship to finite space and time as you currently are. Remember, they try to give you little suggestions about that, you know, once you aren't so stuck the way you appear to be stuck now, like especially say with time, right, you'll begin to let go of thinking so definitively. You know, right now we always conclude that time is some sort of an absolute reality because it appears that way. We're so stuck in it, you know, but no, time's not a reality. Time is not a reality at all. I mean, space is a reality, but time is not a reality. Time is just an appearance. You know, there's no reality to time. And, you know, the reality is motion. Time is just the chronicity of motion. It's an abstraction. You know, it's an appearance relative to that reality, predicated on our inherent consciousness of sequentiality in mind. Overlaid upon that motion, right? And so, you know, once you get a Mirantia body, you know, they tell you, you'll start to be able to actually think about things in a more real fashion instead of having to labor in this appearance of time. You'll begin to think transcendent of time like that. Now, it doesn't mean that you're moving through time. That's, you know, to assume that is to assume time is a reality. There is no reality like that that you can move through. Right? Time is not a reality. And you'll begin to be able to let go of that, you know, and see things in the more, in truer fashion. The real duality is not space and time, it's space and motion. Right? And you'll begin to think in terms of motion in space, you know, and not in this so simplistic temporal way that we think about things right now. And that obviously is, huh? What does that even mean? Right? And it's like, that's why they say, I mean, we can't even really explain anything to you that goes on in even the first Mansion world. I mean, you just have no way to even appreciate the basic sense of environment that you have or anything. And I mean, it's just totally different than the way you think about things right now. Right? Because you'd be thinking more in terms of the reality of it. You know, and instead of your current very crude appearances. You know. So, whenever you bring up transport seraphim, see, this whole bit kind of comes into play about space and time and the reality of them and the relationship of different beings to finite space and time and what have you. But, all right, so what else do we have there? Then there's the one little kind of tidbit. So about 3 days of standard time. Now, if you can't remember, back towards the beginning of part two, if you kind of just remember, it's back towards the beginning of part two, you can probably flip back and find it. Where it is paper, towards the end of paper 33, when they give you the standard day and year and stuff, you know, it's in paper 33, section 6. That standard day is 18 days, 6 hours, plus 2.5 minutes. Okay, so forget about the 2.5 minutes, but just 18 and a quarter days is a standard day.
Don't right? they mean a Nebadon standard day?
Yeah, that's a Nebadon standard day.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, 18, 6 hours.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, not the Uversal one, but the Nebadon one. It's really tough to keep them straight. That's why it's kind of handy to just kind of remember where they are so you can flip back, because I mean, I always get myself confused and I got to flip back and try to remind myself. So it's 18 and a quarter, 6 hours, so 18 and a quarter days. So 3 of those, we're talking almost 55 days.
That's a long time.
Right. I mean, it's almost 2 months. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So it takes a long time to take their material body and slowly, I don't know, part by part, strand by strand, you know, express it in a different energy system until you've got the whole thing rebuilt in a different energy system. This is a slow, you know, laborious process. Speaking of laborious, remember back when they mentioned that before on Gerasim, remember it was in the context of you can't go there, remember? Like you can't go to where the power beings are really active. You can't go to the dematerialization sector either. There's laboratories, right? I mean, this isn't something, it isn't just this transport seraphim just comes up and magically touches this or something, you know, for 2 months and it morphs. I mean, there's some whole elaborate technology, you know, that requires, it says a whole series of laboratories. I mean, it's just some really complicated process, okay, that you have to have a whole installation for, okay? But the actor in all of it, the individual that's using the laboratories and all that technology is the transport seraphim. So somehow they're able to, you know, what needs to be tangible is tangible to them and not tangible to other beings. They can get their hands on it and do the manipulation, you know, and it's kind of interesting. It's not life carriers. Now, you need life carriers at the end, you notice, but the dematerialization is just done by the transport seraphim. So that's very mysterious. And I'm sure this is mysterious to the author of this paper as it is to us, because it's one of those secrets, right? The Father's worlds. No one really understands how some of these beings that have a recessive expression like they do, how they do what they do. Right? I mean, they can understand the physics of sort of the dominant and, you know, sort of out there sort of stuff. But whenever there's something that's sort of recessive, an expression, or an expression of the sort of the coalescence of the whole, you know, and so the physics is not really up front, right? They always say, we don't really understand how that stuff works, right? Because they just can't they can't observe it. They can't get a microscope to it, right?
Yeah. Just a thought on that, it seems to be that... You know, not only can nobody else understand it, it may be that the transport seraphim as well doesn't understand it. That the transport seraphim is acting out of talent. Otherwise, mm-hmm. why would it be necessary, you know, as part of their education? If it's a secret of mm-hmm. Seraphington, mm-hmm. then it's finally revealed to them how this could happen in the same way that on Ascendington,
right, we finally
get to understand what it meant to fuse with our thought adjuster.
Right, exactly how an adjuster can make a soul when there's no Morancha power supervisors and all that sort of stuff. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Those secrets of Ascendington. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it is. A lot of it is just, I mean, that's just, they just do it, you know, by nature, you know, and they obviously would have the best insight into the physics of it, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if they can't write down all the equations for you.
Yeah.
If you will. Yeah.
Not that we could read it.
Yeah. So anyway, right. So like we said last time, I mean, yes, of all the things in the book about transport, this is certainly the closest to the Star Trek transporter. But it's not magical like the Star Trek transporter, right? Where you just totally turn it into amorphous energy. And exactly what happens to the personality and the encirclement of the Holy Spirit and the adjutant mind energy, right? But, this is just intense, incredible physics, you know? Not unlike building bodies for, you know, Prince's staff or something like that. You know, just mind-boggling physics, you know, to literally build a body from scratch in some way.
Good news on the set of Star Trek is they just had to make it appear like that. That's pretty approachable for us.
Yeah. But,
there's no Scotty up there.
Yeah, the quote-unquote Scotty is the transport seraphim here. Right? Yeah. You know, and the transporter room is that series of laboratories. And yep.
Well, the same thing could be said of... of human life.
No.
I mean, we don't really understand how a baby is formed in the womb, you know. I mean, it's just because it happens all the time, we know it.
Yes.
We don't really understand
it. Yes. Yeah, like we were trying to point out, I think that was last week too, wasn't it? I mean, you know, you got to remember, you know, the act of procreation goes way beyond its appearance. It's not as simplistically mechanical as it appears, right? There's overlapping of mind energy involved and all kinds of inscrutable things, you know, and via the mother, a connection to the father, you know, that that gets a particular genetic combination into some sort of infinitely transcendent linkage to a particular personality, and all these mysterious things are going on. And like we said, I mean, it's different. That conception act in a human is connected to eternity, despite all appearances of the contrary, where it appears like it's just the most crude, you know, mechanical thing, you know, ever, involving lots of sweat and whatnot. But instead, it's something, you know, infinitely transcendent is going on there. It's literally connected to eternity and infinity. Whereas the conception of a chicken or a dog or a salamander isn't connected to eternity like that. It's more what it appears, you know. But the higher you go in the animal, the less it is what it appears. Until finally you get to us, I mean, it's infinitely more than what it appears with us. That simple act of procreation. You know, and that's, you know, eventually humans recognize that, you know, and take it more seriously. You know, it's a sacred thing.
Just a thought on the mystery of dematerialization.
Yeah.
Is, I mean, when you go and you look at Lazarus brought forth from the tomb.
Right.
And they tell us here, you know, Jesus says, Lazarus, come forth. Though these human observers remained motionless, the vast celestial host was all astir in unified action in obedience to the Creator's word. In just 12 seconds of earth time, they restore a dead body to a living, breathing human being.
Yeah.
You know, fully activated.
Right. Yeah, and that's a great thing to bring up. So you think about that as a great example. So you get the master physical controllers can kind of just be present in space, you know, and they, you know, they can just think it, and all the automatons assemble together into the molecules of the body and everything, you know, in a few seconds' time. It's like, well, why don't they do something like that here? I see, again, it's, you know, it's like, you know, and say, well, it appears to you that you could do that, but if you understood the physics of what's going on, you wouldn't think like that, right? You know, there's obviously something much more complicated going on here, something that only a transport seraphim can do, that master physical controllers can't do. Now, your first thought is, well, I mean, we are relating to non-material stuff. I mean, you know, this is involving something that's Marantia-like. It's like, well, okay, master physical controllers and Marantia power supervisors, couldn't they just do it in 12 seconds? you know, but apparently, see, it involves something very, very laborious. You know, it's not as simple as just thinking automatons together into the body assembly for Lazarus. Now you got something.
There may be more than one way to do it, but this may be just the most efficient way.
Yeah. Again, see, you just left to speculate. See, like I said, I mean, and we haven't even gotten to the biggie yet. I mean, that's the next paragraph. I mean, really, everything they say in here, you know, there's 100 questions for every answer. I mean, it's just, you know, it just invokes all kinds of speculation. The more you think about it, the more mystery there is. But the point is to, you know, is to really, you know, like stop and, you know, just pass over 3 days of standard time, pause, go up, look up standard time and go, whoa, 55 days? That's a long time. And then we'll see there's even more mystery to that later on in the section. Okay, so this very labor-intensive process is finally completed and they're transported. Now we get a little aside here. get everyone's fear juices flowing here. Let's read the next paragraph.
While there is this dematerializing technique for preparing the atoms for transit from Gerasim to the evolutionary worlds, there is no equivalent method for taking them away from such worlds unless the entire planet is to be emptied, in which event emergency installation of the dematerialization technique is made for the entire salvable population. If some physical catastrophe should doom the planetary residents of an evolving race, the Melchizedeks and the life carriers would install the techniques of dematerialization for all survivors, and by seraphic transport, these beings would be carried away to the new world, prepared for their continuing existence. The evolution of a human race, once initiated on a world of space, must proceed quite independently of the physical survival of that planet. But during the evolutionary ages, it is not otherwise intended that a planetary Adam or Eve shall leave their chosen world.
So you got to just love this. The opening clause and the ending clause, and then they in between those is this sandwich of, you know, doom. You know, so you know, I mean, while there is this dematerializing technique for preparing the atoms for transit from Gerasim to the evolutionary worlds, during, you know, then skip all the way to the end. During the evolutionary ages, it is not you know, intended that a planetary Adam and Eve shall leave their chosen world. They could have just said that in one sentence. Instead, they pulled the sentence in part and crammed all that mess in the middle. Okay, let's just deal with that, the two slices of bread, and we'll deal with the hodgepodge in between the two slices next. But so, I mean, you can see sort of the main reason why it wouldn't be any sort of a straightforward thing to dematerialize them on an evolutionary sphere and take them back to the system headquarters, because where are all those laboratories that they have on Gerasim, right? So if you're going to do this on a world like this planet, I mean, you have to construct all these laboratories, and who knows what the heck that involves and what beings have to be involved in that and whatnot. Right, it's a big to-do. But speaking of big to-dos, I mean, we're not just going to do two. We're potentially doing everyone on the planet here. So how many laboratories does that take?
They need a holodeck. Do you remember the when they did that?
Yes.
They transported the people to another.
Right. We need the cargo transporter here rather than the one with just six pads or whatever.
Two-seaters.
Yes. Okay. So, all right. So now let's take this giant bomb that they threw into the middle of this paragraph. Okay, now they're talking about a potential catastrophe. So, there's an emergency, so just deal with the most straightforward thing. In the middle there, when they say the Melchizedeks and the life carriers would install the technique of dematerialization. So why are the Melchizedeks overseeing this? Does anyone remember what it is that Melchizedeks always are involved in? Right, an emergency. So that's why the Melchizedeks have stepped in, because they're the ones, if there's some sort of an emergency situation, they step in to take the reins of it. And, you know, obviously the life carriers are involved, because you have this whole dematerialization thing going on. You start out with the, you know, rather dramatic statement that an entire planet might have to be emptied. But then they throw in for the entire salvable population. Salvable population. And they don't explain themselves, of course. They just toss that out there and say, speculate away. Right, so, I mean, the only thing you can really kind of get, it seems, from it initially, maybe with some great insight down the road, you can sort this out, but I mean, if it says nothing else, it says that there is some sort of a differentiation that has to be made. There's some haves and some have-nots in some way or another, right? Quote unquote, the haves are salvable. You know, what on earth does that mean? Does it mean only those that have thought adjusters and hence, you know, a soul? You know, and with someone like that, you think, well, maybe they could just transport the soul and build a new body for them, like they do for the kids in the probationary nursery that die, but no, they're dematerializing apparently the same way and giving him this Marantia-like form. Well, and it's like, well, that's kind of interesting. I was thinking maybe the only reason you could give him this Marantia-like form is because of that sort of semi-material nature of the material son and daughter. That maybe was sort of the basis for that sort of transformation. But here we're talking about someone just like me. I don't have this. I'm not semi-material, so I don't have sort of the beginnings of some sort of Marantia-like whole body that I could just, you know, leverage off of. Right, so, I mean, the other thing that this does is it definitively says that it's not just with material sons and daughters or other semi-material beings. It's not even just for, like, Adam and Eve's children when they took them off the planet, you know, after the default. It's not just for Midsoniters, you know, which obviously have a very different sort of a nature that is not really mortal, like they say, you know, and whatnot. But it's just run-of-the-mill mortals they can do this dematerialization thing with.
We'd have to be able to procreate once we got
there. Right. Okay, now you know where this is going, because, see, this is the other thing that comes in. Remember, I was teasing about that last time. Right. So, you know, we know that that Adam and Eve's children, when they were taken to Edentia, okay, when they were rematerialized, they can't procreate. And you know that Midsoniters, when they're rematerialized, they can't procreate. And we were talking about that. It's like, well, does it have to be that way? Or is that part of the rematerialization that the life carrier is involved in, that they just make them so that they can't procreate? But they could have made them so they can procreate. Well, and you can see here, I mean, what would be the point of dragging them to another planet if they can't procreate? That doesn't seem logical. So, I mean, just in the same way, why drag an Adam and Eve to a world as biologic uplifters if they can't procreate after you rematerialize them? All right, but, and on initially you're thinking, well, maybe they're special because they're material sons and daughters. Well, no, I mean, here we've got just plain old material beings like us, and seems like they need to be procreating afterwards, you know, and so it kind of seems to suggest that the ability to procreate after being rematerialized is an option that the life carriers have, that they can turn that on or off. They can, you know, they can decide if they want to have them be fully in relationship to the second phase of life animation and have all of the, you know, mechanical aspects that they need and whatnot for that, or not. You know, kind of like they make the bodies for the children in the probationary nursery, you know, they make them so they're non-reproducing. Right, so
they are pointing out this involves a whole world, a whole thing going on.
Yeah.
That has to continue as if it didn't stop.
Right. Right.
There seems to be an
emphasis
about
anything with us, like your recordings, for instance.
A suitcase?
No suitcases, can't go in transport seraphim. Right.
But what about the whole culture and history? It would be lost.
Okay. Well, you see now. Yeah. So let's get in a little bit. So I mean, obviously, you know, if a world got to this point where they actually had to, you know, abandon ship like this. I mean, you're talking about a radical transformation in the culture of that civilization. So it seems like it allows you to speculate pretty radically about this whole salvable thing. It comes back around to that. I mean, you're not trying to make it as if nothing happened, you know, like you put them all to sleep and they don't even know anything, and you transport them to this world that you made look like just the one they're on and they never know anything happened. No, I mean, this is like, you know, everything's changed. I mean, they can have a completely different culture and stuff, you know, because of this. And so what are they doing here? I mean, this whole quote-unquote salvable thing is, you know, it's pretty mysterious, pretty ominous statement. I mean, are they doing some kind of a very definitive adjudication sort of the situation where, you know, an easy way to get rid of all the lesser strains is just to not transport them to the other world? Or
this is what I'm wondering about. You know? It's making me think that it wouldn't be a cataclysm like an exploding sun or an object striking the planet, because that could be dealt with off planet and they could deal with that easily. It's a very simple thing. Mm-hmm. This seems like it's something that the free will choices of the people on the world have taken the world to a point where it's no longer as sustainable for the people who are progressive on that world. So the world is ruined. Whether they're scorching the earth or something.
Well, see, this is what you get into. It's like, well, okay, exactly what kind of a catastrophe is this? I mean, this is a big mystery too, because we're talking about every world has all kinds of master physical controllers on it, beings that can literally alter the dynamics of a galaxy the size of the Milky Way. Okay, I mean, it's pretty hard for me to do something with a chemical spill that they can't handle. Okay, all they have to do is think it, and they could you know, completely alter the entire planet, right? Like they do when you're in fifth stage of light and life. They just think it and they rearrange all of the automatons of the whole world, turn it into an architectural sphere-like place. And I mean, you know, they just change all the radioactivity, you know, all the plate dynamics, you know, the internal structure of the Earth. So what exactly does a catastrophe look like that the master physical controllers can't just deal with? Like you're saying, I mean, an asteroid approaching that would kill all life on the planet, I mean, that's child's play. They can move, they could, you know, they can just think it and alter the sun's output, for Pete's sake. I mean, the only thing I can think of, you got to be talking about something that is, despite all the planning of all the finite and supreme beings, the trans-finite beings, the master architects, have a thing going where, oh, I guess this galaxy is just going to enter the Milky Way like this, we don't even have enough master physical controllers to deal with that, and you know, there's going to be a little chaos in a couple spots. And I mean, what is it? I mean, it has to be something above their pay grade, as it were.
What if they don't want to interfere with free will and just let us poison ourselves to death, which we're kind of in that, being poisoned? Maybe they're just going to let it happen, and it will become uninhabitable.
Right, so you think. I mean, where do you have free will?
Well, we have it to destroy a lot.
No, we don't. Where do you have free will?
Personal choice. Inner relationship.
Only in the inner life is the only place you're sovereign. We're not sovereign in the outer life.
Mm-hmm. But they let it take its course.
Right, to a degree. But the Most High is ruling the kingdoms of men.
But right. Maybe they won't, and they're going to let us.
Right. See, that's what I said. Welcome everyone to your greatest fears. Right? If you want your fears to run wild, this is the paragraph for you. Right? This is where you imagine everything that it says on the internet is true.
Yeah.
You know, and we're all going to die.
The internet is true.
You know, and not even the master physical controllers can save us. But luckily, the Urantia book says that they'll transport us off. Well, if you're one of the salvable ones.
Right.
You might want to remind yourself of that. You know, maybe they'll give you a thumbs down and you won't get... Right. Now we'll think about our world, you know, in a minute. But just, you know, we're thinking this in general worlds first, right? I mean, it seems to me this has got to be something pretty amazingly, you know, huge scale something, you know, that where a small part gets caught in a big game, you know.
The thought that occurs to me in the context of the fifth stage of light and life, I mean, it takes until the fifth stage of light and life before the physical controllers are allowed.
Oh, to do that, right?
Yeah. Yep. So then I go back to, okay, maybe it's a matter of universe law and constellation legislation, that somehow before a world attains a certain state, we're not allowed, you know, to not experience just regular vicissitudes. After all, what's the difference between an asteroid hitting a planet and, you know, meteors, you know, hitting a non-breather, you know, or just, you know, Chernobyl affecting, you know, its 60-mile radius or whatever it is.
Or Stalin killing 60 million people.
Exactly. all of those kinds of things that are that can happen. And so there's, I agree with you that the, you know, the physical controllers being able to do any of that should be able to do whatever. We don't really know what the parameters, their allowable action is.
Yeah, and see, and the interesting flip side of that is, you know, that's a great point, you know, to bring in the reflection. It's like, you know, maybe they just need to kind of let the evolutionary process run its course, and if it's kind of heading for everything going down, you know, going to hell in a handbasket, well, you got to sort of trust the supreme and let it go to that. You know, and you don't want to do anything dramatic to save the world. Well, we're kind of talking about doing something dramatic here.
Very.
I mean, how is this less dramatic than the master physical controllers, you know, fixing the problem before anyone notices there's a problem? I mean, you know, this is just like a radical thing, you know, especially when you bring in the salvable thing and you're trying to figure out, I mean, you know, are we talking about 10%, you know, get a thumbs up, or what are we talking about here? I mean, you know, like I said, I mean, one thought is, I mean, are they talking about, do they only save the ones that have gotten thought adjusters so that they have a soul? You know, and it's like, well, what about little children that haven't gotten to the point where they can have thought? Well, maybe they all have to go to a probationary nursery. You know, I mean, you can think of some pretty radical things here.
They'd have to apply the same laws, for lack of a better word, that they were going to use for going on to the mansion worlds, and they'd have to give anybody that has any. Those are all salvable.
I see, that's what I mean. The salvable word is just like a huge word. Like, salvable in what sense? Relative to what?
I mean, anybody short.
You know, they literally take someone everyone knows has gone to iniquity on their nativity sphere. They know their soul is completely empty. They cart that empty soul, the seraphim, cart that empty soul to the first mansion world. Yeah. They build a whole Mirage body for that Mirage brain. They stick that empty Mirage brain into that thing. They all step back. You know, they go through the whole rigmarole. And so why is there the word salvable? You know, if you say, if that's the way it is normally, why would there be any qualification here? Why wouldn't it just be save everyone? We would sooner resurrect someone and it would lead to a system rebellion than not resurrect them. I mean, so why is the word salvable there?
Well, they probably, those who don't go on the new planet, go to the mansion worlds. They just kill them off and take the others to the planet.
I don't know. I mean, like I said, we're not going to solve this here, but I think we've got everyone's juices flowing. Just I want you to appreciate how annoying it is when they do something like this in the book. You can't just say that and not explain what you mean by that. You know, they just chug right on. You get to the end of the paragraph, and it's like the whole middle of the paragraph is not even there. You're just talking about Adam and Eve and transporting them, and.
And I would think that since everybody goes on to the mansion worlds anyway, why would there be anything like this at all?
It's all very inscrutable.
Right?
I mean, now, just maybe one little thing in passing, you know, and I always want to stress this. Remember that if there's any world for which they would move heaven and earth to avoid this, it's this world.
Yeah.
Of the 10 million potentially inhabited worlds in this entire local universe, there's one that will be saved even if all the others are lost. Yeah. And that's the one you're standing on. Right? I mean, Michael's world is part of eternity by definition. You know, you don't get to eternity. It's like, oh, well, Michael's world's not there because, you know, I mean, you know, he looked at God wrong one time, and so God just wrote him out of the will. No. Right? This world is part of eternity. You know, so, you know, if they have to have a countless number of master physical controllers rearrange the Milky Way galaxy so that this world doesn't, you know, get hit by some dark island of space or something careening in from the outer space, you know, from the outer regions of the super universe, you know, they'll do that. You know, this is Michael's world, right? So, but there's a lot of worlds that aren't Michael's world, you know, and
some of the language here is interesting.
Yep.
If some physical catastrophe should doom a planetary residence of an evolving race, the Melchizedeks and the live carriers would install the technique of dematerialization. It's almost like it sounds like it's written as a proviso that if it was in an extremis case, they would.
I agree. Yeah.
But it's like it's probably not going to happen. But there is that fallback.
Right. You notice that. That's one of the things that you can go, well, let me look carefully at all the verb tenses.
Yeah.
You know, is it ever in the mode? It's like, and you know, and if it, you know, is required or, you know, when it has been required, you know, it's always just this hypothetical verb tense. Right. You notice that.
Yeah.
So you that leads you to wonder, maybe this is just never happens. But, you know, it's like it's never going to happen that the creator son goes to rebellion. But that mean, does that mean that they don't have it all laid out, the plans? No, remember, they do.
And what it comes to, yeah, no,
they've got it all.
Also the cracks. So there's always that.
Yeah. I mean, they literally, I remember, they allude to the fact that everyone knows exactly what they would do if a creator son ever went rebellious. You know, everyone knows their job if that were to happen. But it's never going to happen.
Yeah.
Right, so is this like that? Is this something that's just, this is what would be done if this ever happened, but it's actually never going to happen. But, you know, but you're talking, like I said, the thing, you could never say never, because the beings that are ultimately in charge are ultimately in charge. Right? The architects of the master universe are the ones that actually have the final say, and, you know, Ancients of Days just have to go along with it. Whatever the heck the master architects have planned, they're not at a high enough pay grade to make these decisions. You know, no one in the finite domain, even if they're supreme beings, know what the master architects have planned.
Right? It seems like that sentence is written as if it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. So,
but that's just me.
I know. All right. So yeah, just everyone so can kind of come to their own resolution of fears relative to this paragraph. It's a good opportunity to see if the only thing you're using your faith for is antidoting fear, or if you've started to move along as Jesus told you to fear not. Can you read this paragraph and fear not? It is delightfully science fiction. You know, we all notice that. For those who love science fiction, you go, oh, this is really cool. This is like that book I read that one time, you know?
Being Michael's
world, I'm willing to stay.
Didn't somebody read this paragraph and then run riot to make a movie called Knowing? Nicolas Cage movie?
I don't know.
And it's about the Earth being, there's like a sequence of events that are escalating catastrophes, and there's some secret code that's been found, and there are these strange, like Midway type creatures who start taking children and taking them off world. And they all end up on a different world, the children do, but most people die and as the sun explodes.
Okay, that sounds like
somebody's read this.
Yeah.
And taken it to Hollywood and had stuff.
And we know there are people, you know, that have connections that have read this, so, yeah. All right, well, anyway. Okay, so meanwhile, back to the final slice of bread at the end of that paragraph, the plain white vanilla bread that just says, but during the evolutionary ages, this is not otherwise intended, that a planetary Adam or Eve shall leave their chosen world. Yeah, remember the way, you know, it normally is. They're throughout the entire sort of post-animal evolutionary process. You know, once you've got all of the animal potentials fully actualized, that's when they come as the biologic uplifters. And they're there from that point until basically there just isn't any evolution going on anymore, and, you know, then they leave, you know, when you're well into light and life. So they really are the ones that span the whole human evolution block. Whereas typically the life carriers are really kind of just spanning the whole animal evolution block of the world. You know, and each of them have that overseer role, just the way the life carriers oversee the whole pre-will animal evolution. Adam and Eve get in there in a very interventionary, very son of a father way, right? You know, and start micromanaging the races, getting them blended together, seeing to it that the things that you don't want procreating don't procreate, and you know, get bred out of the lines, out of the stocks, and you know, etc. Not to mention, once you get all that stuff done and have one race and everything, then they oversee the whole genetic engineering that goes on for ages and ages and ages, you know, even way into light and life. Adam and Eve take over that role of handling, micromanaging human evolution in the wake of the life carriers overseeing animal evolution in a very kind of hands-on, micromanaging way like that. All right. Okay, let's get this last paragraph in here.
Upon arrival at their planetary destination, the material son and daughter are rematerialized under the direction of the life carriers. This entire process takes 10 to 28 days of Urantia time. The unconsciousness of the seraphic slumber continues throughout this entire period of reconstruction. When the assembly of the physical organism is completed, these material sons and daughters stand in their new homes and on their new worlds, to all intents and purposes, just as they were before submitting to the dematerializing process on Gerasim.
Okay, so let's deal with the time span there. So you notice the longest that it takes is only half of what it took to dematerialize them. So that's interesting, that it takes significantly less time to rematerialize them than it did to dematerialize them. Okay, you're going, I mean, I don't know what that means, but just telling you something about the physics of the whole process. Now, can anyone recognize, why is there a range? Why is it 10 to 28 days? Why would there be such a range? And we talked about this many times. This, are they being
type of mind, type of body, physical body?
Yeah, I mean, right, it's along that lines. I mean, when they're rematerialized, are they exactly the same as they were? Right, they're downstepped a little bit, right? All right, so depending upon what race they're syncing them up with, that's going to lead to why there's this range. And remember the fundamental, there's sort of two fundamental things about this downstepping. One, they're downstepped, so now they're not immortal just innately, but they need the addition of the fruit of the tree of life, right? You know, like we said, you know, they're downstepped, and so you got the inputs of this life-sustaining energy from the master physical controllers that normally they're at eye level with when they're on the local system headquarters world. They're downstepped, and now you have this bridging mechanism from the tree of life that brings that life-sustaining energy down to their downstepped nature. So there's that key thing. And also, they're downstep so that now when they procreate, they don't produce either self, sustaining, you know, innately immortal, or I shouldn't say innately immortal, but yeah, you know, sort of immortal children. They produce mortal children, and those children are specifically tuned to the whatever race they have to mate with. You know, which could be radically different if it's like non-breathers or something, right? You know, or 2.5 foot tall, you know, natives, you know, when the shortest mom and dad are 8 foot, like we read in the previous section. All right, so, you know, there can be, you know, the Adam and Eve can only be downstepped so far. But boy, that next procreative downstepping, that's all designed by the life carriers here to be just so can be quite a big step, perhaps, in just in stature, let alone all the other things that might be kind of radically different than what material sons and daughters are like on a local system, headquarters world. So whatever, you know, apparently, you know, what this tells you is sometimes it's pretty straightforward to modify them. But sometimes it takes, you know, almost three times as long to modify them so that they can actually, when they procreate, their children are going to match up with the evolutionary stock on that world. So that's some interesting physics there, too, between the lines. Let's see. Anything else there? Oh, yeah. One other little thing to note. This whole bit about how much are they like the way they were. You know, notice how they say that precisely. They stand in their new homes and on their new worlds to all intents and purposes, just as they were before submitting to the dematerializing process on Gerasim. Does it say that they're physically identical? No. Is intent or purpose a physical world word? No, that's a mindal world, a mental word, right? And it's both intents and purposes. They're saying that intents is just mindal intent. They have basically the same mind that they had before. It has all of the motions in it that it had before. Purpose means that intention goes. It isn't merely a mindal intention. It goes back to a spiritual motive, you know, that came down and was formed a mindal intention, a purpose. So the spiritual and the mental or the mindal are just like it was on Gerasim in our case, but physically they're a little bit different, right? And perhaps not so little if the world is quite a bit different. But obviously they can't be radically different, or there's no way that the mind could be essentially equivalent, because that mind is attuned to the genetics of their body, and they can't have altered that too radically. There's no way that could be all intents. It would be just some intents and purposes, right? So they're just giving you a little hint that most of the differential is not made up by radically downstepping the Adam and the Eve. The life carriers make it so they procreate. And if there's a radical downstepping, it really happens in that next notch, that the kids are quite different than mom and dad.
If you downstepped mind of something, it would no longer be that thing anyway. If you were downstepped and degraded, you would no longer be you. So that has to be maintained.
Right. You see the law. I mean, if they're going to be these beings that are really the fundamental overseers of the whole span of human evolution, well into light and life, I mean, they have to have the highest quality mind, really possible for that. So, yeah, I mean, that just tells you, too, they can't be too radically downstepped, because they have to hit the ground running, They can't build up to what they need to do, way down the road. They got to really have the objectivity right away. So all those things, see, it all makes sense. It all kind of fits together logically. But just, we flippantly use the expression intents and purposes. They're trying to get you to reflect again on what that says. I mean, to understand it more than the humans that coined the term understand it. I mean, it's only when you have, when you understand the physics of the Paradise Trinity and all this sort of stuff that we go through in Total Deity, you totally understand what intents and purposes are. But, at least you can recognize that the essence of it, that it's about mental and even something greater, spiritual behind it. That's all still there, despite it being a new home on a new world. All right. Let's see. We may not be able to get through this whole next section, but we could sally forth and see what we can do here.
Marching orders.
The relatives. I love that they sort of got us to use sally forth again. It's a great expression.
Is salvable, is that the once-or word? Is that the only time that they use salvable?
I doubt it.
Okay. Number 3, the Adamic missions.
On the inhabited worlds, material sons and daughters construct their own garden homes, soon being assisted by their own children. Usually the site of the garden has been selected by the planetary prince, and his corporeal staff do much of the preliminary work of preparation with the help of many of the higher types of native races.
And so the garden at large has all this help from the prince's staff and natives and stuff, but you know their actual homes, are in their hands literally. Now, there's something besides the immediate fact that they're trying to remind you of there. One of the fundamental things that not only the prince and his staff have been doing for a long time, you know, maybe 500,000 years or something before the Adam and Eve got there. But Adam and Eve pick right up and do this, have the same, present the same example to everyone. What fundamentally is it? You know, if you've been recently studying the early civilization papers, it's one of the points they bring up very early on in those papers about how, you know, naturally we don't take a shine to a certain activity. And we have to be encouraged to identify more with this activity. It's, the word is actually in that paragraph towards the end there. It starts with a W.
Yes, work.
Work. There's that indolent, lazy, whatnot thing. The animal origin creature doesn't have in great measure, you know, naturally, right? So they're modeling work very definitively, trying to ennoble the concept of work and get people to pull themselves up by the bootstraps and do that too. It's like, I want to be like Adam and Eve, because they're really cool. I mean, there's so many things that are just totally cool, mesmerizing, you know, to the natives about them. They glow in the dark and they're beautiful and majestic and whatnot. You want to be like them. You know, and so it encourages people to start working. When you see that that's that demonstration of loyalty, you know, to work, right, is very important for those children, the natives of the world, you know, to observe and to learn from working. And, you know, there's no way to have a civilization when people begin to fall back to the primitive state where they're trying to find the path of least resistance, where they're trying to get something for nothing, you know, where they're trying to find, you know, do anything except work, right? Why is this book in my lap? Think about the culture you're living in. Are we losing our affinity to work? Are we starting to think of our more and more clever schemes? Or, we're voting more and more for politicians that are promising to give us something for nothing, and right, we're becoming ease-drifting souls. Right, we're losing these lessons that were encouraged a long time ago. You know, and civilization will collapse if we do that, because primitive people, shy away from work, and primitive people are not civilized. It's just the way it is.
Well, there is the demonstration part of it, but it's also their nature. I mean, where they come from, they work. So it's not something that they're doing just for show. They are...
Yes, exactly. And so, isn't that interesting? What a coincidence that by nature Adam and Eve's work like that. It's really, there are no coincidences in supremacy, right? And you see how it all works together as a system. They aren't faking it, just for the benefit of the natives. They do it naturally, and hence they do it... innately loyally, and with such sublime sincerity, that everyone observes that, right? And that's important, right? It just comes naturally, and everyone else challenges themselves to be natural like that too, to not grumble when you got to do something and just do it. And of course, Adam and Eve over time see to it that all those that grumble don't procreate as much, and eventually all you have is those that are like them, and it's very natural for them to work. Right? But they start modeling it nonetheless, right away. First thing they do, start building their house. Okay.
These Gardens of Eden are so named in honor of Edentia, the constellation capital, and because they are patterned after the botanic grandeur of the headquarters world of the Most High Fathers. Such garden homes are usually located in a secluded section and in a near tropic zone. They are wonderful creations on an average world. You can judge nothing of these beautiful centers of culture by the fragmentary account of the aborted development of such an undertaking on Urantia.
Ah, yes.
Can you say grotesque?
but we try to rummage through the scraps anyway to try to find something. Something to hold on to. That's all pretty straightforward. But again, just like we saw at the beginning of the paper, okay, how this paragraph starts. These Gardens of Eden are so named in honor of Edentia, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, does that mean that they speak Hebrew on high? Because the word Eden is a Hebrew word, right? No, right? It's just like with Adam and Eve, like they said up front. You know, remember, Eden is Hebrew for delight. Right? The Garden of Eden is the Garden of Delight. You know, and, Edentia is the delightful place. You know, if you want to take it that far. You know, it's the Edenic place. And it's the delightful place. That's what they're saying. You got to penetrate to the root. So they're just reminding you that on every world, there's going to be the word that's going to be in play for the garden is something that basically means delight, you know, or delightful or whatever. That's what they're telling you about this. You know, the constellation headquarters is not named in Hebrew, you know, with a modified Latin suffix added to it, right? I mean, right, it's not the way it works. All right, so you know, take the truth of it. Again, you know, if you don't want to think in some simplistic, you know, like Bible literalist sort of mentality or something about this. Right? I mean, it's not a revelation of fact, it's a revelation of truth. Right? You know, so read those sort of statements as a statement of truth. And to get to the easiest way to start to get to the truth, like I've said so many times, is you need to penetrate to the literal meanings of words, because they're using the words truthfully. You know, they're not just using them factually, picking definition number 3 out of the dictionary. Right? They're using the true spirit of the word. What that word came down from the cosmos, and you need to follow it back up to the cosmos in order to understand how the revelators are using it. You can't just use it down on the plane where you exist. You got to follow the truth of the word up in order to get to the truth of its use in the book. all right. But we can judge nothing. I mean, it didn't seem to even give us a scrap there to... You can judge nothing of these beautiful centers. When all is said and done on our world, that's not so bad, because we weren't supposed to have a long-standing garden anyway. Remember, the whole plan was just to have a garden for a short period of time on this world. That's why they built it on quicksand, basically. They built it on a location they knew was, you know, short-term, was going to sink into the Mediterranean before very long anyway. It was just to get them started there, and then they're on this planet, they're supposed to move out and just have regional centers and stuff. And we're not supposed to be a world with a garden, the same garden as the beginning all the way to the end, like a normal world. We're not a normal world. We're a decimal world. I mean, just, you know, the normal things aren't in play here, and that's a striking example of that. You know, we would have had a still-standing planetary headquarters, you know, I guess, yeah. But... you know, and that brings into, you know, the play, the master physical controllers probably would have had to have a lot to do with maintaining that sort of permanence or something. But nonetheless, on a normal world, you've got this garden that gets started, and, you know, way back when, and goes forward in time in a near tropic zone, so everyone doesn't have to wear snorkel parkas, you know, and whatnot. And but you notice it's near tropic. Because you don't want too much of that salubrious climb thing happening, right, with the natives. So you bound it away from the tropics a little bit. You know, especially for Adam and Eve, you know, who are used to running around naked, you know, and now have to put on some clothes. You know, they don't want to go from naked to snorkel parkas. All right.
No openings.
If you aren't familiar with, you know, say, Air Force or Northern United States winter garb, you don't know what a snorkel parka is with a ring of fur around the.
Planetary Adam and Eve are in potential the full gift of physical grace to the mortal races. The chief business of such an imported pair is to multiply and to uplift the children of time. But there is no immediate interbreeding between the people of the garden and those of the world. For many generations, Adam and Eve remain biologically segregated from the evolutionary mortals while they build up a strong race of their order. This is the origin of the violet race on the inhabited worlds.
And again, you can judge nothing. Oh, sorry.
All right, so, you know, that's all pretty straightforward again. You know, we all know that, like they said up front, you know, they expand upon all this, you know, later in the book. But, you know, the one thing to just note that they state so definitively right here is right at the beginning there, that in potential they are the full gift. You know, physical grace to the mortal races. So, you know, you have the fullness of the evolutionary process reaches its apex in and of itself. So that's a complete fullness. And then you bring in a second complete fullness. You know, this is very much like the analogy we use in other areas, you know, the up from the bottom evolutionary phenomenon, you know, is a full lower hemisphere. You know, and then the revelatory element that is brought down is a full upper hemisphere. You know, so just like with the human philosophy, lower hemisphere, divine revelation, upper hemisphere, to give you the full sphere of philosophy, you have this similar thing, analogy here that they're trying to paint, right? That you have two full halves that come together to give you the full whole. You don't need anything else. And the reason that's very important, because lots of people read the Urantia book, love to speculate pretty wildly about all kinds of things that could happen biologically and stuff. And they try to get you to recognize that the full bottom-up evolution thing, that was all there, you know, way back 40,000 years ago. Okay, and there's no more of that, you know, anagenesis, as it's called, that vertical evolution, right? That's going to that can be teased out in any way, shape, or form. I mean, it's all there. You reach the apex. You know, you don't get an Adam and Eve until you've actualized all that potential. You know, and everything else comes from them, either literally, biologically, like they're describing immediately there, or indirectly through their guidance of genetic engineering to finish it out, right? So, you know, when you think about how we're going to recover from the default, right, you can't bring in all sorts of imaginary pieces, right? There's no magic wand that's somehow going to make our, you know, our just bottom-up evolutionary, you know, biologic evolution somehow go further. It's already gone as far as it goes. Right? There's, you know, everything else has to happen in Adamic-like fashion. And if you don't literally mate with these creatures, like we can't do anymore, you've got to do it through genetic engineering, like they always guide. You know, just you've got to think in those constraints. You know, those, you know, if you speculate that, like some of the revelators do, that you're going to bring some of those Adamic children back from Adentia, right, they're not procreating. You know, no one's going to mate with them. You know, they would just oversee like mom and dad were supposed to. Or if you go like with some of the Revelators or Machaventa is going to assume material son. That just means he's going to oversee like Adam and Eve were supposed to. Oversee that, I mean, initially they've got to oversee getting the races blended together, weeding out some of the detritus, you know, and then eventually genetic engineering upon that strengthened foundation. You know, that's the way, it's going to be very much a scientific process. It's not going to be something that just kind of happens naturally because of some innate genetic potential, right? It has to really, and it'll have to be overseen in a very active scientific way. Right, and we all know that, there's variations on the theme on this planet, but the basic idea is you build up a lot of violet race before there's any mating that goes on. Yeah, I mean, there's things like that. You know, you'll have you'll build up a million before they do, or whatnot. Yeah, I mean, it all varies from world to world. But just, and remember, with ours, they had all the complexity. You got, you know, red man all the way over in the North Americas, and you got to deal with them separately, and you know, so. But the whole point is you don't start out just. Well, we got two you know, Adamic children. Let's mate them. You know. I mean, you get you go through many generations so that the violet race is sort of fully manifest as a race that's synchronized with that world. I mean, especially the first generation of Adam and Eve's children, you know, they're a little bit not quite, you know, settled down into relationship with the evolutionary stock yet. They have kind of sort of one foot still in mom and dad's genetics, right? You know, so you have to take it in, you know, a number of generations so it settles down into a nice, stable equilibrium, you know, race that is at eye level, basically, you know, with all the other races. You know, that's the main reason why they don't mate right away like this. Right? You go through enough generations so that you've got that that sort of fully stabilized stock.
I find interesting is the number of million. I was wondering, it's like 32,000 years ago on this planet, what the amount of total population in this world is.
Right.
The proportion of the million compared to the population at that time, if the planet had gone right, would have been quite large.
Right. Yeah.
It would have been a big infusion of genetic difference.
And that, just the same thing I was just saying. I mean, you build them up so that you really kind of have the same numbers and whatnot. It's a kind of quality and quantity. It's like there's this other race that's sort of the same magnitude as the other races on the world.
Yeah.
Right? See? And then you blend it together. Yep, exactly. let's see. Did we get everything else there? I think. Yeah. Okay, let's keep going.
The plans for race upstepping are prepared by the planetary prince and his staff and are executed by Adam and Eve. And this was where your material son and his companion were placed at great disadvantage when they arrived on Urantia. Kalagash offered crafty and effective opposition to the Adamic mission. And notwithstanding that the Melchizedek receivers of Urantia had duly warned both Adam and Eve concerning the planetary dangers inherent in the presence of the rebellious planetary prince, this arch rebel, by a wily stratagem, outmaneuvered the Adenic pair and entrapped them into a violation of the covenant of their trusteeship as the visible rulers of your world. The traitorous planetary prince did succeed in compromising your Adam and Eve, but he failed in his effort to involve them in the Lucifer rebellion.
Okay, yeah. And again, for more information, see paper. Right, I mean, we all know that they explain that in greater detail, you know, later on. you know, and especially the did the Melchizedek receivers talk to Eve? We know, because of that more immediacy of impatience. But when all is said and done, impatience, you know, was the big issue for both of them, you know, and they equally were disillusioned that very first night they were there, like we've talked about here recently. I mean, they didn't make it 24 hours before what they're saying, you know, really hit to them. You know, normally the planetary prince really gives us everything, and we just execute the plan, right? You know, and just, you know, it's just amazing. Even with all this special preparation and stuff, again, as we were stressing it. I can't remember who it was. Someone was stressing it about this nature, you know. With the work that they just have that by nature. I mean, you got to remember that they just have a certain nature, and they have a very hard time going beyond that. That's another thing that's different about celestial beings than us. Most celestial beings are kind of narrowly created, narrowly defined. They function in a very circumscribed sort of space. They can't be creative outside of certain very narrow boundaries. That's why there's all these different orders of them. They can do a very specific job very, very well, better than any other being in the universe of universes. But that's a lot of times is about it. You know, we're innately, you know, much more, much broader in our potential. And it's fundamentally because we're, you know, an ascending phenomenon by nature, whereas most of these beings are very horizontal by nature. They just don't have that depth of nature. They're quite shallow. And that shallowness, when you're talking about a celestial that's down in the lower levels of the hierarchy, it doesn't take much stress, and that shallowness comes out. Right? And they don't have the depth of insight that, you know, that they need a lot of times. You know, even a Melchizedek comes up a little shallow at times and makes an error. He's not objective enough sometimes. Doesn't have enough depth sometimes. Right, so that's the that's the basic thing that's happening here. You know, the fact that they didn't have all of that sort of spoon-fed to them like is normally the case. That's why that very first night they're staring off into empty space, you know, and it feels just as empty between their ears as it does in the vast dark sky. And really they, you know, it was all downhill from from day one. Inertia carried them 100 years and that was it, you know.
Satan was no slouch.
Right, yeah, I was just going to mention that. Yeah, yeah. I was just going to give them a little credit. You don't want to be totally hard on them because, notice, crafty, effective, yeah. Wily stratagem, you know. Remember, the Lunanodex are very brilliant, clever, you know, individuals. But you can overcome a lot of raw brilliance with just a little bit of insight, right? With just a little bit of insight, I can understand why where someone went wrong, you know, 200 years ago in their theory, you know, and they were 100 times more intelligent than I am. But a little bit of insight goes a long way, and that's all they needed—just a little bit more insight to penetrate through the fog, you know, that he was putting up.
I wonder how well prepared they were for how he was going to behave.
Yeah,
before their arrival.
I know we all kind of wonder that because they give you little hints that they got a lot of prep stuff and. But boy, you know, it seems like it didn't go very far.
And the person that he would be the person that they would rely on. They rely on each other, but as a pair, they relied on the plan. He could easily affect them. With his wily schemes.
Yeah.
But I just wonder if they weren't pre-prepared to expect him to be that devious.
They minded you right there. Even if they didn't remember what they got taught on Gerasim, when they got here, the 12 Melchizedek receivers sat them down and kind of, you know, and they're going to mention Salonia. Salonia was right there too, you know, talking to them, and still. So it reminds you how they kind of have this kind of innately childlike nature that they can't overcome. They just can't be as an adult of God as they need to be. And a lot of that adult stuff is just offloaded to the planetary prince. I mean, he's the adult in the room, and that means they don't have to really be. You know, so when they don't have a planetary prince, see, so that's another lesson. I bring that lesson up all the time, that you can learn from this for you, right? Yes, it's wonderful that you're by nature a child of God, but you don't live on a world that's running all delightfully smoothly with a planetary prince and his staff and an Adam and Eve and all that sort of stuff and a full biologic uplift. Okay, and now the Supreme has pushed us out of the sheltered bays and we're out on the high seas. You can't just rest on the laurels of being a child of God. Child of God are going to die on this planet, right? They're going to destroy themselves. They're too ignorant. We need to challenge ourselves to become adults of God, just like Adam and Eve, unfortunately, couldn't do it. The only reason everything didn't fail with the prince's staff is because there were 10 of those staff that were more adults of God, and the rest of them were too childlike and couldn't handle it. But Van and those, were picked by the Most Highs because they were not so childlike. They had more depth. They were more adults of God, and they had enough insight to penetrate through Caligastian crew and say, yeah, right. Right? If you can't do that, it's going to go tough for you on this planet, and ever more so. Okay, but it didn't, the last statement there, we all know, it's just a default, not a rebellion. It didn't push him into full conscious embracing of evil. All right.
The fifth order of angels, the planetary helpers, are attached to the Adamic mission, always accompanying the planetary atoms on their world adventures. The core of initial assignment is usually about 100,000. When the work of the Urantia Adam and Eve was prematurely launched, when they departed from the ordained plan, it was one of the seraphic voices of the garden who remonstrated with them concerning their reprehensible conduct. And your narrative of this occurrence well illustrates the manner in which your planetary traditions have tended to ascribe everything supernatural to the Lord God. Because of this, Urantians have often become confused concerning the nature of the Universal Father, since the words and acts of all his associates and subordinates have been so generally attributed to him. In the case of Adam and Eve, the angel of the garden was none other than the chief of the planetary helpers then on duty. This seraphim, Salonia, proclaimed the miscarriage of the divine plan and requisitioned the return of the Melchizedek receivers to Urantia.
There's Salonia. You got to love the little alliteration there. Remonstrated, reprehensible. They couldn't resist. I want to wag my finger at you. But it is kind of interesting that they use such a strong word like reprehensible. The fact it was just a fault, as they just mentioned, not rebellion. But it kind of speaks to what you were speculating. I mean, the fact that it was reprehensible seems to indicate that they were extensively taught about this, who knows, they probably ran simulations and stuff. I mean, they've got all kinds of sophisticated sort of things that they can do on high, and yet still, guys, really? Yes, it's just technically a default, but still, the violation of trust is huge, and that's why it's reprehensible. It's just such an extreme violation of trust. 100 years, guys, really? How old are you? I mean, you think about how many millennia old are millennia. I mean, it could be, and they last 100 years. And then, you know, they never miss a chance to kind of toss in a little Bible comment, you know, about how we've got the quote-unquote Lord God, you know, in the garden. Where are you? You know, you remember the story in the Bible. Well, I was hiding because I recognized I was naked. You know the way the story goes in the Bible.
Yeah.
It brings us back. You know, we're referring back to, you know, we went through that paper where we had all the different orders of angels. Remember the planetary helpers. You know, here they finally have a chance to talk about that fifth order in context, right? Instead of abstractly like they did, you know, all those papers back. You know, and we've got a, you know, usually about 100,000 of them. That's a pretty big crew. You know, and we've talked about that. You know, it's easy to forget that there's, you know, we always just focus on guardian angels, you know, but there's just gazillions of angels doing all kinds of things that we never even think about on this planet. Lots and lots of activity all the time. And again, you know, don't let that slip out of your mind so easily so that you feel like you're all alone in the world. Right? I mean, there's just the number of just angels on this planet working without sleep, basically, you know, all the time, everywhere. You know, just that it's there. Trust it. Don't turn the molehills into mountains all the time. You
know?
Yeah.
100,000 angels, part of their duty, however, wasn't to direct Adam and Eve.
No, man, Adam and Eve are boss, right? You know, I mean, you remember, you know, how Adam fits into the hierarchy of fathers, right? I mean, he's the father of the realm. You know, it's very much an evolutionary phenomenon. It's, you know, mostly it's you got a person in charge, and they just, everyone just goes with what that, the will of that personality feels is appropriate. Right? There's that respect of will.
Good, bad, or indifferent.
You know, even though someone, you know, much higher and wiser would say, "Well, I wouldn't have done it that way." You know, they don't intervene and prevent them from doing it that way.
Remonstrated and said, "Look, you've broken it." After a minimum chiseled eggs, but that's basically what happened. That remonstration sounds like it's a subordinate basically was saying, "I can't believe you've just done this."
right. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I'm supposed to be under you.
Yeah.
Okay, a little bit more chant. You know, they're using this opportunity to talk about some side issues here, so they bring them to midwayers here.
The secondary midway creatures are indigenous to the Adamic missions. As with the corporeal staff of the planetary prince, the descendants of the material sons and daughters are of two orders. They are physical children and the secondary order of midway creatures. These material but ordinarily invisible planetary ministers contribute much to the advancement of civilization and even to the subjection of insubordinate minorities who may seek to subvert social development and spiritual progress.
It's one of my favorite little ominous lines in the book. Okay, before we get to that last one, though, just the other things here. Remember that there's all kinds of variability about how the secondary midwayers come into play. I mean, the primaries, you know, it's all very regular from world to world, but the secondaries come into existence through all kinds of different methods that they don't enumerate. You know, we know it's really oddball way we got them on this planet. But in the bigger picture, you can think of them as the other type of children, like they're saying here, even if they aren't literally, directly, the Adam and Eve children, like in our case. But nonetheless, they're a manifestation of Adamic blood being in play. Right? Just like the primaries are a manifestation of that very Marantia material combination and the prince's staff being in play. Right? You can't get secondaries unless you have Violet blood in play, one way or another. You know, no amount of mating with the Nodites produced secondary midwares. You know, even very early on when they might be pure or whatnot. And you gotta have Adamic blood. So there's a, you know, so there's some mystery there, see, that has to do with this relationship to things that are not so material like us that allows that phenomenon to tap into this eventuating phenomenon of bringing secondary midwares into existence. And then, yeah, they're ordinarily invisible, like we all know. I mean, just, you know, if they leave the knob in the neutral position, they're invisible. You know, they have to turn the knob to make themselves visible. Then that last sentence. It's very easy to forget, you know, because this is the only spot they mention this. You know, that they're, you know, they're not just used, say, for destiny reservists or things like that. But they're used as, you know, kneecap busters here to some degree. The subjection of insubordinate minorities.
What's the word subjection? That's kind of an odd.
You will be subject to the following, it's like with the divine executioners, you know, that which ought to be, you know, that ominous line with them. You're going to subject them to, you're going to remind them that ultimately they're not in charge on this planet. You know, and you want to think about this a little bit more. I mean, when you think of insubordinate minority, you know, what probably pops into your head? Probably not what they're talking about. Something that, you know, the only kind of phenomenon that's going to need to be actively engaged like this is something that's very animated by spiritual energy. Right? It's only going to be someone that has unbridled spiritual consciousness and is racing off in a very ignorant, destructive mode, you know, that they're going to have to intervene with here. And so I always try to remind people, you know, if this whole bit about, you know, the angels of progress have checkmates, right? Not the other way around, not even checks. The problem is always if someone gets too excited about trying to make then now. What do we want? The ideals in the eternal future. When do we want it? Now. That's the problem.
Well,
you know?
Who are they?
Right. Well, just see that. Just keep that in mind. I mean, it's always interesting to think about. About, you know, there's been minorities throughout history that have been very spiritually conscious, had great ideals, and got very animated, and they didn't succeed. Might be just a coincidence. Might not be. They might have actually had a monkey wrench thrown in their works. They might have actually been subjected to some over-control. Right? Not because their ideals were evil. It's just that they were ahead of their time. Right?
Do you have any examples?
No, of course I don't. Of course I don't. But it's just a humility thing. Right? The whole point is just to have that humility. Recognize that you may validly see a very remote ideal, but now may not be the time. And if you get too effective, you may get thwarted. There actually may be a conspiracy, but it's not a conspiracy of unenlightened humans like you think it is. It may actually be the secondary midwares saying, okay, that's wonderful in the future, but no, that's too disruptive right now. The stability of the Mori system can't, you know, be maintained if you are too successful and along that track. You're going to completely mess everything up. It's just a, you know, it's just a point to keep in mind, a little bit of humility. The Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men, and there's all kinds of others that are involved in that rule. Mm-hmm. Right? And if something is too soon, it's too soon. It doesn't matter how much you try to make it happen. Okay, let's keep going.
The secondary midwayers should not be confused with the primary order, who date from the near times of the arrival of the planetary prince. On Urantia, a majority of these earlier midway creatures went into rebellion with Caligastia and have, since Pentecost, been interned. Many of the Adamic group who did not remain loyal to the planetary administration are likewise interned.
Okay, well, we all kind of remember that. You know, at Pentecost, all of the rebel angels of various types and midwayers were taken off the planet and put on the prison worlds. Yep, keep going.
On the day of Pentecost, the loyal primary and the secondary midwayers effected a voluntary union and have functioned as one unit in world affairs ever since. They serve under the leadership of loyal midwayers alternately chosen from the two groups.
Again, just notice how they wanted to give you this kind of complete thumbnail sketch, but we all know that, you know, a lot of the details are in other places in the book about this, but they're just trying to lay out the full thumbnail sketch. As is always the case, it's important to remember, it's like, well, where do they exactly say that bit about interning, you know, at Pentecost? I mean, it's here, right? I mean, you know, you'll be looking and looking in the big passage, you know, it has all kinds of other stuff and you can't find it and you're going, well, maybe I just imagined that, you know? I mean, they do that all the time where they, I've mentioned that several times in recent, sessions. They try to get you to think as holistically with the book as possible. You know, they don't give you the path of least resistance where you can find everything you need by analysis, just going to a particular sentence or paragraph or section, you know, and there's the part, and it's complete. Right? They're trying to encourage synthesis all the time. You know, and so they scatter the parts throughout the book. You know, so that you know, forcing you to try to encompass the whole of it as much as possible.
Do the same thing at King Super.
Do you suppose they're motivated by sublime synthesis and higher philosophic recognition? Or are they just trying to get you to be intrigued by more shiny objects in various places around the store?
I think it's Alan Funk's little brother that knows Don Green has his number.
Midwares, most of them joined the rebellion. So the ones who didn't, did they have any external leadership, or was it just they had the integrity within themselves?
No, remember, it was very chaotic. You know, a group of them tried to get it all coordinated, but it didn't really work, and so there was just kind of a little subgroup that had a little bit of order to them, and there was a lot of loyals that weren't even really kind of organized and were sort of just doing their own thing for a long time. You know, and so until Pentecost, when everything was kind of finally brought together, it was all sort of haphazard and, you know, whatnot.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's why, you know, you can see things in history that seem to speak to sort of ad hoc actions of loyal midwayers, you know, as well as ad hoc actions of disloyal midwayers. You know, they say, well, you know, what can I do? I'm bored. What am I going to do to, you know? Well, maybe I should go up to Northern Europe and, you know, and try to encourage something there. Or maybe I should go to South America, where those Andites came over, and encourage something there, and so the loyal ones, you know, are messing around in Northern Europe, and coincidentally, there's tales of elves, right? You know, things like that, you know, because they were all just sort of just trying to keep themselves busy for years and years and years on end, you know, without any real definitive leadership. You know, the Melchizedek receivers, you know, were really only of immediate influence to that kind of small group that kind of put themselves under their leadership. The rest of them were freelancing. the whole time. So,
your world has been visited by four orders of sonship: Kaligastya, the planetary prince; Adam and Eve of the material sons of God; Makavinta Melchizedek, the sage of Salem in the days of Abraham; and Christ Michael, who came as the paradise bestowal son. How much more effective and beautiful it would have been had Michael, the supreme ruler of the universe of Nebadon, been welcomed to your world by a loyal and efficient planetary prince and a devoted and successful material son, both of whom could have done so much to enhance the life work and mission of the bestowal son. But not all worlds have been so unfortunate as Urantia. Neither has the mission of the planetary atoms always been so difficult or so hazardous. When they are successful, they contribute to the development of a great people, continuing as the visible heads of planetary affairs, even far into the age when such a world is settled in light and life.
Okay, just a closing thought is to combine what we just read there with what we read, you know, back in the previous paper, right? The last section of the previous paper, do you remember? So when they say, but not all worlds have been so unfortunate as Urantia, you should say, yes, but the greatest affliction is never to have been afflicted, because I am an Agendotter. And I am forged of Agendotter steel. All right. Right. I mean, that's the challenge that's lying between the lines there. Right. Is that even though it might initially appear that you got the short straw, right? Did you really? Right. Do you only judge it by its actuality? Or do you judge it in full? The actuality and the potentiality. And the potentiality is infinitely greater than any actuality. Right? And on this world, there's more potential than on a normal world. So, you know, like I was saying before, just, you know, to challenge yourself to not judge things merely by their limited appearances. I mean, because there really can't be anything but limited appearances this early on relative to the grand universe being settled in light and life, right? You got to see the potentiality. You got to see the potentiality. It has to be just as real to you as the actuality. After all, you know, they tell you that for the Father there is no difference, right? If you identify a lot with God the Father, you know, as an initial child of God, well, then identify with God the Father. At least do that. At least see things as he sees them. There's no difference between potential and actual, right? And judge the world you live on accordingly. Now is a divine dispensation. If you include the potentiality, you can know that. But you'll never believe that if you only judge it by its appearance. And as soon as you make that transition and base your life on the reality of this world instead of its appearance, your faith will grow into trust, right? And there can be some assurance predicated on that trust. But until you do that, if you continue to do the childish thing of judging things by their appearance, you'll remain forever that fearful child. Right?
The author intentionally became wistful
here. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I just don't feel wistful like he expressed.
Well, remember the poignancy who the author is. It's a secondary Lenonidek, remember. You know, he expressed that before. You know, every time he thinks about Kaligastya, it's like, really? My brother, how could you think that way? How could you do this?
It's interesting as well that they talk about how much better Michael's passage here would be, but he wouldn't have come here.
Yeah, right, exactly.
We're the planet we are because of the difficulties he chose.
Yes, yes.
He didn't pick an easy job.
Right. And so again, see, you know, there's another thing between the lines that you can get there. Oh, you know, I'm always doing that. I'm always getting caught up in my spiritual consciousness, you know, and just be, you know, regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future. Oops, I shouldn't do that. You know, so in between the lines, he's reminding you of that tendency that you'll have if you get, if you too get too biased to the, you know, your spiritual idealism. It doesn't end up being positive. It ends up being negative. Regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future. That doesn't sound positive to me. You know, and that's where most people with spiritual consciousness on the planet are. Right? They use their spiritual consciousness as an error and evil detector. You know? And where's that going to get you? It's not going to get you to peace that passes all understanding. Right? You're going to get more and more frustrated, you know, to the point where you start to actually become militant of mind, right? You've got to get a bridle on that spiritual consciousness and get it into line. all right. So next time we'll get a little bit more into that task besides just procreating with the natives. They've got the whole oversight thing like we talked about. So they're going to, you know, we're going to get into that a little bit more as we go forward here. You know, have fun speculating about whether or not you're a salvable.
A salvable. It might take the whole book to sort that out. I think that's about
All right. Let's take a moment, everyone.